When the writer and journalist Christopher Hitchens died of cancer late last year, there was, unsurprisingly, a flood of tributes paid to a man who had devoted so much of his career to public controversy and provocation. Particularly in his final years, Hitchens became identified with what has become known as the New Atheism. Now, what exactly is new about this atheism has in itself been a bone of contention, not least among atheists themselves. And there are certainly those who consider it more a media-generated phenomenon than a coherent program of ideas. Together with Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, and Daniel Dennett, Hitchens was sometimes hailed in the United States as one of the four horsemen of the new atheism, a playful inversion of the four horsemen of the apocalypse from the book of Revelation. There can be no doubt that together they and others have presented an increasingly vocal and aggressive challenge to the premise of organized religion as an intrinsically positive aspect of Western society. More than once, Hitchens described religious faith as evil nonsense. "I regard it as an enemy," he said in 2008, "and a real deadly one." Of course, the temptation for those of us who value religious faith is to become either irritated or defensive whenever we hear such sweeping condemnation. And it does seem that whenever convinced atheists speak in this way, they resemble no one so closely in their own bigotry and dogmatism as those religious fundamentalists they routinely hold up as exemplifying the problem. Extremists, whatever it is they may believe, do indeed seem to be ultimately cut from the same cloth. They inhabit a moral universe that is a zero-sum game, where there must be winners and losers, where mutuality and conciliation are not signs of enlightenment, but of weakness. For the new atheists, scientific inquiry is the only hermeneutic that counts, such that even belief in God can and should be treated as a testable hypothesis. They reject outright the premise that religion might ever address questions of ultimate meaning that transcend the confines of their own intellectual categories. In the same way, of course, religious fundamentalists, be they Christian, Muslim, or Jewish, approach the world in a similarly myopic way, rejecting or distorting every idea that cannot be made immediately intelligible in terms of their own conception of divine truth. Now, with an irony that, of course, none of them would ever recognize, what such extremists share in common is that they all practice idolatry. They quantify, they fetishize, and then they worship something that they themselves have created. Like the Israelites in our reading from the book of Exodus this evening, they cannot cope with ambiguity. When the people become anxious about the absence of Moses after he has gone up the mountain to meet with God, their immediate impulse is to manufacture their own gods down below. They prevail upon Aaron the priest to make them a golden calf, an object of adoration that reflects back to them their own sense of worth and accomplishment, and indeed, certainty. Frightened and angered by the demands of their relationship with the living God, the people transfer their longing onto an idol that they alone can define, and onto which they can project their own fixed notions of value. Which is partly why, at least, they are memorably described by God as stiff-necked people. Staring straight ahead at what they already understand, they are too rigid to look beyond themselves to new meaning and new possibility. New possibility in this case as mediated by the prophet Moses. What religious or even agnostic people today must resist is a similarly rigid response to the aggressive stance taken by the new atheists. When figures such as Hitchens and Dawkins peddle their own kind of idolatry, a golden calf born of their obsession with the supremacy of human reason, it is all too tempting to start manufacturing idols of our own. That is, in the face of such assaults, we are tempted to close ourselves off from what we might learn, preferring instead to quantify and consolidate what we already know. Even those people of faith who are hardly to be counted among the zealots can all too easily, under such conditions, find themselves falling into new and ever more subtle forms of idolatry, in precisely the effort to remain faithful to their God. Of course, for those of us who call ourselves Christians, the antidote to this idolizing impulse is the life and witness of Jesus Christ himself. For his is preeminently a generous vision, one that again and again invites us to engage human life as a celebration of its plenty, rather than as a cataloging of its limitations, which is precisely what differentiates him from both the avowed atheist and the fanatical believer, both of whom can only imagine life in terms of what must be repudiated rather than what might be embraced. But in the gospel accounts, we constantly see Jesus making tangible his sense of God's extravagant generosity. Be it the turning of water into wine at the wedding feast, or the feeding of the 5,000 on the hillside, somehow with Jesus there is always enough to go around. Everyone somehow gets what he or she really needs. And it doesn't take much imagination to realize these stories are just as much about the sharing of love as they are about the provision of food. In our gospel reading tonight, what ultimately qualifies Peter and his companions to become Jesus' disciples is their willingness to cast their nets into the sea just one more time, even when their own recent experience suggests that this is a futile thing to do. At Jesus' prompting, they are willing to take a gamble on plenty, on the possibility that life will always offer more than we expect, that God will offer us more than we ever thought possible. What the new atheism brings into bold relief, among other things, is the fact that many modern people find the claims of scientific method and religious belief confusingly difficult to reconcile. The new atheists themselves have been happy to promote and exacerbate this perceived tension, for such is the nature of their mission. But not all scientists by any means share this approach. And here the example of the late Stephen Jay Gould is a salutary example of an alternative way of thinking. Gould, an internationally renowned paleontologist and evolutionary biologist, was, by his own ready admission, very much a man of science, but not of spiritual belief. And yet it was Gould who, in 1997, proposed the concept of non-overlapping magisteria. That is, he posited that science and religion are asking fundamentally different questions and have very different means for looking for the answers. In Gould's terminology, borrowed from the church, this means they are in essence separate magisteria, realms of knowledge and authority. If religion can no longer dictate the nature of factual conclusions properly under the magisterium of science, he concluded, then scientists cannot claim higher insight into moral truth from any superior knowledge of the world's empirical constitution. This mutual humility has important practical consequences in a world of such diverse passions. The reality is that science and religion are never so straightforwardly separable as Gould himself was the first to acknowledge. But what makes his suggestion compelling, it seems to me, is that it is based on a premise of what he calls mutual humility. Such humility is the antithesis of that idolatry that both sides of this perceived conflict are wont to indulge in. Indeed, it has much more in common with the generous vision Christ promotes and enjoins in his followers. It is an attitude all too aware of human limitations, and yet relishes the process of conversation and learning. It is an attitude that Christians and other people of faith could do worse than to take up in the face of their most virulent critics. It will not only save us from idolatry, it may well contribute to that freedom we so crave, that freedom to live that life of plenty to which God is calling us. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.